This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, where I go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, and scholars who are making the world a more libertarian, or at least a more interesting place, by championing free minds and free markets. My guest today is Michael Shermer, the founder of Skeptic Magazine and the author, most recently, of Truth, What It Is, How to Find It, and Why It Still Matters. We talk about what it means if your name is in the Epstein files, and I'll tell you straight up, both Shermer's and my name are in the Epstein files, why Holocaust denialism is rising, and why free speech is more endangered than ever. And we talk about why Enlightenment values such as open inquiry, rational argumentation, and representative government must be defended. Here is The Reason Interview with Michael Shermer. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. And we are talking with Michael Shermer, who is a repeat guest, a repeat offender on The Reason Interview. We're going to talk about his magazine, Skeptic, which has been publishing since 1992. We're going to talk about his general work and his life, including some embarrassing things, I hope. But we're also going to mostly talk about his new book, Truth, What It Is, How to Find It, and Why It Still Matters. Michael, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks, everybody.
So let's start by talking about the fact that you're in the Epstein files.
Oh, my God. Is this okay? Hopefully this is the embarrassing part.
Yeah. Well, that depends on how much is unredacted, right? But you recently did a podcast, and all of your stuff can be found at skeptic.com and elsewhere. But you talked about how you're in the Epstein files, and the whole kind of Epstein files miasma, or I'm going from a miasma to a cloud, and I'll call it a swamp or a pond or whatever, but it has become a shorthand for a way of talking about deep truths about people that oftentimes don't make any sense. Can you talk about how you showed up in the Epstein files
does it mean? Okay, so 2017 was the 25th anniversary of Skeptic Magazine. So I thought, well, we should do something to kind of promote it or whatever. So I hired a PR firm here in New York to put on some sort of an event. And they said, okay, we're going to do this public event and we need some celebrities. Who do you know? I said, well, I know like Richard Dawkins and Steven Pinker and some other scientists. They go, no, we mean real celebrities. Like, oh, okay. Well, I know Deepak Chopra. And they go, okay, Deepak, that's a big name. He knows everybody. Yeah, okay. So Deepak came. It was fun. I vaguely remember he said, it's okay if I invite some of my friends. I'm like, yeah, I don't know anybody here. So, yeah. So it turns out, as I found out a couple of days ago, you know, some of those friends included Jeffrey Epstein and two guests, female friends or whatever. Anyway, I have no idea who was
the friends, employees.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So that was it. That's the entirety of it. So.
But then, you know, this gets thrown around like, okay, you're in the Epstein files. I'll cop to the fact that I'm in the Epstein files.
Oh,
and I'm in the Epstein files for a very specific reason, that on a listserv that I guess Epstein was on, somebody had sent around an interview I had done in 2011 about Bitcoin. So it's like I'm in the Epstein files. We're in a weird, bizarre club, but not in the way that people talk about it. And at Skeptic, you had a fantastic article about, you know, one of the things, and this gets to this idea of your book about truth, you know, what it is, you know, how to find it and why is it important. It talked about this idea, which is everywhere now, that it's obvious and it's irrefutable fact that Epstein was Mossad or was working for the Israeli government. At Skeptic, the author of that article kind of runs through, how did this come to become an incontrovertible fact? And can you talk a little bit about that? Because that eases us into the themes of the book.
Right. So, I mean, one of the questions about Epstein is, how did he make his money? You know, where did all that money and power come from? Because all the rich people here in New York apparently know each other. And they're like, he wasn't in our club. So so there must be some Jewish money behind it or something, or the Mossad. So, you know, that was a meme that started years ago. And then, you know, you have a file dump of 3 million documents. People go in searching of a pattern. And you can find almost anything, just cues here and there. But, you know, in terms of, you know, negative evidence, what should exist if X is true? So if 9/11 was really an inside job, then all those WikiLeak documents, there should be some paper trail somewhere from the Bush administration paying somebody to do this or that or plant the explosive. There's nothing. So the lack of evidence, the dog that didn't bark. you know, is an indication that's probably not true. If we never landed on the moon, we faked the whole thing. Shouldn't there be something in the document, the top secret documents about this? So that's the problem with the Epstein files. You would expect in millions of documents there'd be some paper trail of how he was paid by the Israeli government or Mossad agent contacted him here. There's nothing like that. It's just these kind of brief, fleeting references that then patternicity, you connect the dots and make some meaningful pattern out of random noise. It's easy to do. People see stuff in the clouds or UFOs or whatever. And I think that's all that's going on. It's still a mystery, you know, how he made his money. The one conspiracy theory I've heard, it's not mine, that the sex part on the island was secondary to what was really going on, which was, you know, raising money from these rich people that he could then later, not exactly extort, but the equivalent of saying it would be a shame if those videos got out. Now, would you like to invest in my, you know, investment tools? Right. Now, we don't know that that actually happened, but
yeah, because
like
then
that.
You would expect some of those videos would have leaked anyway.
Something like that.
Or
yes, right, yeah.
You would know how he got his money. There would be some kind of paper trail or something whatever.
But, you know, again, Mossad, Israel, the Jews, pretty much.
Jews are real.
Pretty much every.
There might be some in the audience tonight, which is, you know, you will know, you can spot them a mile away if you know how to look. Yeah.
Yes. You know the story of the guy walking along and he sees the rabbi with the parrot on his shoulder and he says, "Oh my God, that's really cool. Where'd you get it?" And the parrot says, "Brooklyn, they're all over the place." Okay, anyway, so.
Very nice. You also, before we get to the book proper, you recently, I think it was on Twitter, after Rene Good was shot by ICE or, you know, in Minneapolis. This was fascinating, both the Rene Good shooting and then also Alex Preti, the guy who was shot later. You know, immediately there were an avalanche of videos from different perspectives, and everybody was kind of like saying, okay, well, you know, I've looked at every possible angle, and this is how I piece it together. You know, people in the Bush administration, particularly about Preti, you know, we're saying he was a left-wing assassin who had come there that day to assassinate, you know, government agents and things like that. You went through how you came to a kind of conclusion that Rene Good was doing what?
Oh, well, okay. So, I mean, first of all, in terms of like video evidence clearly shows that we could determine the truth from that. Obviously not. You know, with, you know, say Fox News on one side and MS Now on the other side showing the exact same clip saying you can clearly see right here she's doing and then what? Innocently pulling away, intentionally running over the agent. Okay, they can't both be true, right? So this is the problem with interpreting even clear video, much less blurry videos like of UFOs or whatever. So that's a problem. But then multiple sources and multiple angles and other videos helps to clarify it. Well, the evidence, as far as I know, is that it's a combination of bottom-up organic protesting, which happens, and then some top-down organized, you know, Soros money or whatever that's funding some of it, you know, with apps and saying, okay, we're going to get organized, we're going to go do this, we're going to do that. And it looks like both of those were part of that. Observers who were then – so here the gray area is it legal? Is it legal peaceful protesting to be in the middle of the street blocking traffic? You know, so there's a gray area that could be solved in a court case or investigation or something like that. What I actually was writing about, though, was taking personal responsibility for what happens to you. And, you know, and I said umpteen times, they should have never been shot. We don't believe in capital punishment for protesters, no matter how unpeaceful they are. That's wrong. And maybe there should be an investigation of the guys that shot them. Yeah. Okay. But if you put yourself in that position, you know, here you got a bunch of barely trained or, you know, plausibly trained agents, big guys with armor and guns, and you're going to get up in their face and tell them to fuck off and blow whistles and so on and hope nothing bad happens, hope they don't lose their cool, lose their temper. That's a pretty risky thing to do. Now, maybe you think that's the right thing to do. No. Okay, fine. But there's a risk with that. That's all I was saying. And people just were not happy about
that.
Does
the cause matter when you talk about that? Because, you know, otherwise you're kind of, it's the reverse of the thug's veto. You're giving, you know, the government's veto, where if they poorly train a bunch of people who don't know what they're doing, and then, you know, they make it riskier to protest, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. So it goes both ways. But I was just boasting because everybody was piling on the ICE agents. Well, okay, but the protesters are not completely innocent here in terms of just personal responsibility, not legal. What happened? That's all.
I just wish they had been driving an electric vehicle. That's just right. Because
low emissions.
Did they have to also add to the carbon footprint of Minnesota? Well, let's talk about the book Truth, which is a fascinating read. And, you know, you start off early on, you say that there are no truths with a capital T in the world of science or in the world of human reality, but there are objective facts that we can get at and a reality that we can get at, even when we realize our understanding of things is always provisional and subject to change. Can you talk about how this plays out? Like what is behind that, you know, that process?
So I start with the idea that whether there's a God or not, I have my doubts, that I know for sure I'm not God and you aren't either. And I know none of you are. So none of us are omniscient. So none of us know anything with 100% certainty. So you take a Bayesian probability model to say whatever the claim is, it's somewhere between 1% true and 99% true. True with a small t could be a provisional truth. It could change. Change your mind when the evidence changes. Adjust your priors to your credence that changes when the evidence changes. So that's just kind of basic. So I start there and just say, whatever the claim is, like you have a conspiracy theory about Epstein or whatever, might be true. Now let's look at the evidence. Rather than just saying it's nonsense or whatever, then that leaves it open for people that you're engaging with. These are mostly conspiracy theorists that I deal with to say, oh, this guy's listening to me and he thinks I might be right. So I'm going to try to make my case. Okay, good. Let's do that. And then look at the evidence. Yeah. And that's, I mean, really, this is kind of basic research methodology in science.
When did that become dominant in, you know, Western civilization is like a bad term, for, you know, as far as I'm concerned. Which? But, you know, like when did that kind of reasoning become dominant? Oh. You know, and can you, I mean, the book in many ways is a very clear defense of Enlightenment values and Enlightenment epistemology. Can you talk a little bit about how we got to a place where that is the way, you know, even Christians who believe in, you know, anti-evolutionary theory at the Discovery Museum in Kentucky, they use scientific logic to convince the other side. Where did this thought process?
The sort of mid 19th century, the word scientist didn't even exist. That was coined in the 1850s as, you know, somebody that does science. Before that, they were just natural philosophers studying nature. And the idea of like sort of using induction and then testing hypotheses and gathering evidence, that really is only maybe a century and a half to two centuries old. And then even the refinements of that, like how about a randomized controlled trial? Mm-hmm. You know, that's fairly new. I mean, that's the kind of statistical models that really operate on that for like medical research. That's not even a century old. So all that, you know, why are the creationists doing that? I mean, why don't they just do what they always did? They said God did it and that's good enough. But that's not good enough anymore in the age of science. We feel like we have to make some kind of plausible argument with evidence. And that's across the board that people do that now. Yeah. I mean, why not? So I have this, you know, the chapter on religion and, you know, Jesus was really resurrected from the dead. Okay. This is a Christian tenet that.
Well, it's one of the basic tenets.
Why not just say this
also,
is what I believe?
You were a Christian at a certain point.
Oh, yeah. Well, right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying
is this the embarrassing part?
No. Okay. It's up to you. It depends on what group you were part of, right? You know, talk a little bit about that. So then, you know, Christians say that Jesus was resurrected from the dead.
They have to prove it? Why does it have to be actually true? I mean, centuries ago, it was just, well, that's what we believe, and that was fine. But in the last several centuries, there's been a whole series of arguments. Like, this is why it's really true, which shifts it from an internal personal truth. This is my truth. You have your truth. And that's fine. You're a Jew. I'm a Christian. You're a Muslim. Whatever.
Let's go beat up on the Hindus.
Now, yeah. But now it's like, but no. We have to have cogent arguments and rationality and reason and empirical evidence for this, and that's where it transitions from you know, an internal subjective truth to an external objective truth. And the moment you say that, then I'm going to say, okay, what's your evidence for that? Anyway, so they like, for example, I've met Christians who just say, this is what I believe. I'm not trying to convince you of anything. It just works for me, makes my life better. Okay. Then I say, fine. But the moment they then say, but here's the reasons I believe it. And really you should accept those reasons too. And to which I say, okay, if the resurrection evidence for this is so good, why don't Jews believe it? Well, they don't understand the argument. If they just read the books and they look at the, come on, really? You think these learned rabbis don't know what the arguments are for the resurrection and why they reject it? And to me, it just comes down to religious truths are in a different bin than empirical truths.
What brought you to Christianity? Were you born again? You had an experience, a cognitive emotional experience? And the reason I'm asking that is certainly not to embarrass you, but did that experience where you're like, wow, I believe that, you know, Jesus was, you know, the Son of God, came here, took away our sins, was resurrected. You know, that feeling that overtook you when you believe that, does any of that show up in your rationalist work?
Well, I was 17 and things are very different when you're young.
Yeah.
I wasn't raised religious. It was the early 70s, 1971. It was kind of the burgeoning evangelical movement in which people just found Jesus and the whole thing without an affiliation with a church. And but I took it seriously, and I went to Pepperdine University to major in theology. I just really wanted to be a college professor because it's like the best gig in the world. You get paid to have all this time off and read and teach. And anyway, that's what I wanted to do, and theology would be my field. And then, so I took all these courses, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and so on. But when you're in that world view, the worldview is internally coherent, logical, it makes sense. They give you all the arguments, criticisms, and they go, here's our response to those. And so you kind of come out going, I got this down, foolproof, it's bulletproof. And then I went to a secular university for graduate school, and nobody was religious, or if they were, they didn't talk about it. It was just not important. And then I realized, oh, okay. And you know, then I took courses in the history of religion and comparative mythology, the Joseph Campbell stage.
Yeah.
I said, you know, I was like, well, what are the chances that I got the right one and all these other people are wrong? You know, so just some basic epistemic humility. Like, I could be wrong. And then that just sort of opened the door.
Do you think it's incompatible to be a religious believer and be a really good scientist?
Well, there's plenty of them, so apparently not.
Yeah.
But I think
pause, though, like somebody like Isaac Newton wrote as much about the Book of Revelation as he did about physics or calculus.
Well, but in Newton's time, there were no atheists that you know anybody would publicly state, even in Hume's time. So, you know, different culture. A lot of working scientists today are deeply religious. Okay. I think they just keep them in logic-type compartments.
Yeah.
Again, this is my religious belief over here. These are my scientific beliefs. I just keep them separate. Now, there's one theory about this religion. The book is called Religion is Make-Believe. So here's the analogy. When the parishioners hear from the preacher that there's a parking lot in the back of the church, they can just go check themselves. Well, yeah, there is or there isn't, right? But when the preacher says, you know, God is three in one, one in three, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, how's anyone going to check that? Like, how am I supposed to know if what this guy says is true or not? And there isn't. And so they either accept it because, well, that's what our tribe believes, that's what our religion, or they don't, and they go to some other church. And there's no like, okay, we're going to run the experiment here and we're going to find out once and for all if this is true. That's a different animal entirely.
You know, it's kind of clear what people get out of scientific truth, right? You can replicate, you can explain things, you can anticipate, you know, the same outcome if you take certain elements or chemicals and mix them together and it does this, which is good for, you know, business or the world or whatever, and you grow better crops and all of that. What do people get out of a kind of religious or a cultural belief that does not submit itself to that same kind of scientific reasoning?
Well, that internal subjective truth, this is what works for me. Like, meditation makes me feel better. Okay, I have nothing to say about that because I don't know what it feels like to be in your brain. You know, the problem of other minds. But if somebody says meditation actually works, I mean, really works, all right, do you have any evidence for this? Oh, yes, we ran this this trial in which we had, I mean, Deepak Chopra actually did this at his Carlsbad Chopra Center, where he had like professional meditators and then amateur meditators and then people that didn't meditate at all for like a whole week. And then he took like blood draws to measure stress hormones and blood pressure and health outcomes and all this stuff, and found that the professional meditators really did have better health outcomes and better low stress levels, whatever it was. There he's trying to shift it from meditation works for me to meditation actually works.
Yeah.
So from subjective to object.
Do you consider, is he a fraud?
Okay. I know Deepak pretty well. I think he genuinely wants to help people. I don't think, I mean, he's got plenty of money. He's got more money than God. He doesn't need to sell these.
But God doesn't exist.
I think he really.
Maybe money doesn't exist, right?
Well,
God didn't kill
the
himself.
Libertarian position is it's fiat money. Anyways, I think we're getting off track. Anyway,
yeah.
I don't think so. But yeah. But the point is, okay, when somebody says, I've had a crisis in my life, and I found Jesus or whatever, and I'm much better off now. I'll give you two examples. So Isaac Hayes, remember the Grammy Award winning singer, theme from Shaft and all that stuff. So I met him just randomly at a friend's Thanksgiving dinner. He's sitting right across from me. Right at the time, he was famous for becoming a Scientologist. And here I am, Mr. Skeptic of these kinds of things. So I just, as politely as I could, say, Isaac, why are you a Scientologist? He said, well, Michael, I was up here at the top of the game. I had all the money and fame, and I lost it all, drugs, alcohol, the whole thing. And these people pulled me out of that and saved my life, and I have a new life and a career. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to tell this guy, but it's all bullshit, right? I mean, there's no Zeno the Galactic Warrior. I'm not going to do that, right? And Ayaan Hirsi Ali is, maybe you'll have her here. She has a book coming out this year saying, she went from being, I'm famous for being an atheist, to I am now a Christian. Why? Well, part of it is a personal, talk about this, what happened to her and why this saved her life. Okay, I'm not going to take that away from anybody. But there's another move there, because also culturally it's better. Okay, so this is like I'm a cultural Christian. You'll hear even Dawkins says, I'm a cultural Christian, right? What does he mean by that? Well, the argument is that the Western values we cherish are grounded in a Judeo-Christian worldview. Even if you don't believe the woo-woo stuff about the resurrection or the cracker becomes the body of Christ, you don't have to believe any of that. Just the believing the foundations are good for democracy and capitalism and the rule of law and individual autonomy and rights and civil rights and so on and so forth. Okay, that's still a different kind of bin than, but it isn't actually true. And I think it's okay to just say, that there could be something there.
Part of the reason you wrote the book is because we're in the age of science, and it's interesting when you say, it's like 150 years old, maybe, 200 years old, if we're stretching it. But part of what you talk about is, there is a rise in the number of people who say, no, I reject kind of scientific or Bayesian reasoning or whatever. And it's like my truth. And that's all I need in order to kind of force it on you. Do you feel like, do you feel like we're going through an era now where people are retreating from a shared reality or a search for a shared reality or an objective reality in favor of these more personal truths that we kind of force other people to inhabit, whether we can prove it or not?
It's hard to say if it's really different now because of the recency effect and the availability heuristic. We notice it. It's online. And, did they not do this in the 60s? No, they did do this in the 60s. Right? I mean, so, but the two threads that you can track, the kind of postmodern lit crit deconstructionism.
Love. Yeah, we've talked about this in the past.
This
is my jam.
That shifted to the science wars in the 90s, where science is just another narrative story, no different from anybody else's narrative story. There's no such thing as objective truth that's out there to be discovered. Right. Okay. So that's the one thread. And then the other one now, the kind of post-truth fake news thread more on the right. And then, okay, so, and COVID didn't help with any of that. The trust in scientific and medical institutions plummeted for good reason, I think. And the Academy has just gone bonkers on a crazy far left, woke, progressive, trans, blah. Yeah. You know, I mean, you have this Senator Josh Hawley is having this interview with a gynecologist who, you know, can men get pregnant? You know, and she can't answer the question. So, just, I mean, imagine a centrist voter going, what? What is he? What did he ask her? I actually composed on Twitter my answer to that. The snarky version is, no, Senator, men cannot get pregnant. Why are you asking? What's your interest in this? But the less snarky one is, of course, men cannot get pregnant. But I have some patients who are female, who identify as male, and they call themselves men. Mm-hmm. And if they get pregnant, then yeah, by that definition, okay. But of course, they're still women. Why not just say that?
Yeah.
And the answer seems to be, because I've tested this out, she would get canceled by the left. They would say, oh, no. You can't say that she's still actually a woman because we want to say that they're actually men. Yeah, but they're not. So there's that push between. So, I mean, you guys all know, because you're libertarians, Deirdre McCloskey.
Sure.
Okay, so Donald McCloskey transitioned to Deirdre. As an adult, well in, I think in her 30s.
50.
So, 50. 50, yeah, okay, so. To there, okay, fine. That's her truth, internal. That's fine. I have no objections to any of that. Whatever you feel inside, okay. But the moment that you then say, okay, now this is an example, and we have more data, and this is why 14-year-olds should get double mastectomies if they tell me they feel like a boy. No, hang on, hold on. Now we're in the realm of evidence and research and a consensus, and what do the medical institutions say, and so on. There was a rush to judgment on that. You know, the Tavistock Clinic in England was closed. The National Health, banned it now after the CAST report came out saying we never had solid evidence for any of this. Let's just stop it now. The United States is much slower to follow the evidence of that.
Not to linger too long on the trans issue, but you know we're going through a series of court cases and laws where it's saying, you know, the state is saying that it is absolutely, you are not allowed to do certain types of medical procedures. You're not allowed to give certain types of drugs to people who say that they're trans. How comfortable are you with something like that? Because, you know, again, you're not a postmodernist, you're the opposite of it, but you do believe in epistemic humility. And like, do we want the state to be able to make decisions that happen between patients and, doctors?
Okay. Minors. Let's make a distinction.
Okay, but then they're parents, adults, right?
Well, but the parents are uninformed. The parents are told. We know how this unfolded. Yeah. The parents are told, would you rather have whatever is a dead son or a living daughter? Right. In other words, if you don't go along and affirm your teenager's or child's statements that they feel like they're in the wrong body, they're going to kill themselves. And here's the data showing the rates of suicide, which was all wrong. Bunk. Yep.
But the same token, once you say, well, you know, the state gets the final call on how you raise your kids.
Okay.
Is that a loophole suddenly we're all learning, you know, we have to say the Pledge of Allegiance or something horrible that?
A lot of these doctors are doing it for just pure financial reasons. Yeah. They don't care what the parents, if the parents did the research, they come in, here's a double mastectomy, it's $50,000 for, yeah, we're just going to do it. They don't really look at it. Yeah. So here I do think, okay, I've sort of come around a little bit from more libertarian like you to well, we need some regulations here. And including for like prostitution, because, you know, I always was libertarian. What do I care what consenting adults do in their privacy? Okay. But in fact, there's a lot of abuse of women and girls. And, you know, they get in this maybe late teens, early teens, a lot of drug abuse. And really no one was doing anything about it. I think sometimes we need state regulations for this.
Sure.
And in the financial markets too. People will cheat the system if they can.
I had as a note that you are now back to calling yourself a libertarian after a period where you had
audience.
Kind of.
But this audience, I'm libertarian. But,
yeah, no. And you know, by the way, it's not anti-libertarian to say I believe in regulation. I don't think.
Yes, okay.
You know, there's matters of degree. What prompted you? We talked years ago where you were like, yeah, I'm kind of done with libertarian as a descriptor. Now you're kind of back.
Okay, it's just the words. Yeah. I mean, because I'm a feminist. People go, what do you mean by that? I'm a libertarian. What do you mean? They have stuff in their head, what they think that means. And then I don't want to spend 15 minutes explaining what it means. Why not just say, what's the issue? Immigration, abortion, whatever. Yeah. And I'll just give you my position. Call it whatever you want.
You want more.
I like classical liberal because it has kind of a little gravitas to it. Classical liberal, enlightenment, humanism. I don't know. Not into labels.
Let's talk a little bit about historical truths because, you know, and this is related to religious truths, but not necessarily where, you know, again, most of us believe in, you know, if the science works, if the manufacturing process is reliable and it has good outcomes, you know, like, we all believe that, right? In historical truths, you talk about how important it is that we understand history as it actually happened or the closest approximation to it. And you talk in particular, you have two long sections, which are fascinating, both about the Holocaust and the Rape of Nanking, which was took place in the 30s when Japan occupied part of China. Talk about why is it important that historical truths not be simply what some people say happened, you know, but that there's something there. And how important is it to really force the issue so that, to the greatest degree possible, any society or any group has a shared understanding of what actually transpired?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have to. I mean, national history, I mean, national characteristics are mostly based on a historical trajectory, some kind of journey we've been on together as this group. And so if you don't get that right. All right, so I didn't think this was going to be an issue until like in the last year when Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson and others were channeling David Irving from the 90s, you know, just asking questions. You know, I'm not saying the Holocaust didn't happen, but how did they burn that many bodies in these crematoria that could only operate at this level? I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying I'm just curious, which is bullshit. They know what they're doing. They're taking you down a pathway because I've seen that before. All that was debunked in the by myself and others, and then in the Irving trial in England when he sued Deborah Lipstadt for calling him a Holocaust denier, which I did also, and he didn't sue me because I'm not Jewish and she is, and I was friendly to him and she wasn't, whatever. But, you know, he was thoroughly destroyed. And the historian Richard Evans hired all his grad students to go through every single thing Irving ever wrote. And discovered that, of course, there were a lot of errors, but you would find errors in any book any historian ever wrote about anything. But the difference was all of David Irving's errors were in one direction, exonerate the Nazis. Hitler didn't know. You know, it actually maybe didn't happen like we thought it happened. And Goebbels meant this and so on and so forth. And they never go in the other direction. There's no randomness to the errors. So that tells us purposeful distortion. That's one detection of fraud in science, is where all the data goes in one direction. You know, if you look in a lab's data charts and stuff, they're messy and there's errors here, errors there. But if all the errors go in one direction, it's probably fraud. Okay. So I thought we were kind of done with that. And it does matter whether it happened or not. Now you can, okay, so there's historical truths about what actually happened specifically. Then there's interpretations. You know, should we have nuked Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okay. Well, you can do the calculations. If we hadn't done that, this would have happened, the counterfactuals, or you compare Dresden and Hamburg to Auschwitz or whatever. You can see the differences. Right. That's okay. Those are legitimate debates. And that's what real revisionism is like. So like, was it really 6 million Jews that died? Well, if you actually look at the research on that, which it is, like somewhere between like 5.9 and 6.1. But then people like Irving and now Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens will say, you know, they got this wrong and this wrong. Maybe it was, you know, 2 million. Maybe it was 1 million. You know? Then all of a sudden it didn't happen. And that's why it matters that we know exactly what the number is.
And is it because if it starts to become popular that it never happened, it will happen again? Or
no, it's that. In this case, it's that, you know, who's to follow the money? Who's profiting from this Holocaust fake story? Oh, the Jews. So there we are. We're back to that. Yeah. Israel. Israel's getting money from Germany based on the number who were murdered. So they want to exaggerate the number. Actually, that's not even true. The reparations paid by Germany to Israel, not based on the number died, the number survived that moved there. Anyway, so, but that's just, you know, one of 100 things that they purposely distort. And I don't know what's worse, that Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson know that they're bullshitting and lying.
You assume that they are bad faith actors.
I don't know what, maybe I do. I don't know. Maybe it's the financial motive of podcasters to get more people to say the more crazy stuff you say, the more.
Do you feel like, I mean, and again, you know, this speaks to a lot of your work, you know, or is that that kind of contrarianism, which might be financially motivated, it might be psychologically motivated, whatever, you know, is that rising or is it, you know, within the normal kind of ebb and flow of craziness?
Well, it's that stuff has always been there, but now there's a platform for it, the technology and the financial incentives to do it, because you have, you know, small donations through Substack and so forth, that you can get a larger following and support yourself. It was much harder before that. I mean, David Irving, I mean, he had to like meet in these little hotel rooms and publish these little newsletters. It was nothing. But now those people have millions of followers. They go on Rogan and Carlson and these kind of huge shows. And
is there a bleed over from, or have you found that people who believe in one conspiracy theory tend to believe in all conspiracy theories?
The data shows that. If you tick the box for, you think this is true, you're likely to tick the box for most of them. Mm-hmm. My favorite example of this was a paper called Dead and Alive. So the people who ticked the box that said Princess Diana was murdered are also more likely to think she faked her death and is living in, you know, South America with Elvis or whatever.
Yeah.
She can't be both dead and alive.
So that's part of the search for like a rigorous truth. I mean, it helps to inoculate society against people who are apt to believe all sorts of unsubstantiated.
Well, that things. And also the interpretation by the scientists that did that research was that it's a signal for general distrust of any authorities, any media, any government agencies, intelligence agencies, anybody that's involved in whatever it is. I don't trust any of them. So, yeah, she was murdered. Yeah, she faked her death. Whatever. Whatever the story I'm being told, I don't believe it. So it's kind of a global skepticism.
You mentioned in passing, talking about how COVID led to a lot of people not trusting medical authorities, you know, both state ones, but also private researchers or whatever. How much of the kind of post-truth world that we live in, how much of that is a response or an emanation of the failure of people who should have been doing better work to actually be honest and open?
Yeah, a lot of it. I mean, you know, Jay Bhattacharya, who was the co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration in the fall of 2020, you know, just voiced the skepticism, you know, maybe we should reopen the schools and reopen businesses because it looks like here's where the data is right now, and he was right, that the most affected by the virus were elderly, obese, medical preconditions, diabetic, not children, right? And for this, he was called by Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins a fringe epidemiologist. I don't know if you've ever met Jay, but he has a business card that says fringe epidemiologist. It's funny. Yeah. He has two PhDs, one in economics and one in, you know, medical research, whatever it is, you know, at Stanford University, where he's a professor. That guy's a fringe epidemiologist?
Really? Also a Christian.
Yes, I know. It's okay.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, as is Francis Collins.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Let me.
I think that didn't help.
Yeah. I want to touch very quickly on, you have a section on determinism versus free will. How many of you in the audience believe in free will? How many of you felt you had to raise your hand for reasons that you don't feel understand? I don't know. But could you very quickly, because this is something that haunts the Enlightenment, right? The idea, you know, whether, you know, in Descartes, you know, are we puppets who are, you know, being, our strings are being pulled by some shadowy person or thing or a series of forces that make us act a certain way. And we only are tricking ourselves into believing we exist and we have consciousness, and we have free will. This haunts the Enlightenment era, right? This is why Philip K. Dick is such a powerful writer, because his characters are all haunted by the fear that they might be a dream of somebody else. Do we have free will, or how you have a very interesting kind of description of what free will really means. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I'm a compatibilist, which means you acknowledge that we live in a determined universe, but that there's some way to get human volition out of this. The other position, libertarian free will, which is not the...
Right,
yeah,
no.
That there's like a little homunculus up there making the decisions. Your soul, your person, your whatever, which doesn't actually give you free will. As Dan Dennett pointed out, that just means the soul is making the decision, not you. And then who's making the decision for the soul or the mini-me? there would have to be a mini, mini me inside mini me making the decisions for me and so on all the way up. So that doesn't work either. And neither does quantum physics uncertainty give you free will, because that just means it's random. All right, so here's my argument. I'll just give you the 30-second argument. So the question that determinists ask in a challenging way is, could you have done otherwise? Just pick any decision you made in your life. Rewind the tape and play it back. Could you have gone left instead of right, or taken this class, or married that person, or gone on this job or not? Now, if it's literally a read-only memory tape, you're just rewinding it and playing it back, then no, because that's just a recording of what you already actually did. So the past is determined, but the future has not happened yet. So the future is not predetermined. And so here I invoke Heraclitus. You can't step into the same river twice. It's not the same river. You're not the same person. And no matter what scenario you have projected going forward that's similar to some past scenario, it's never exactly the same. Cannot possibly be the same. It's not the universe we live in. The universe we live in has entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. The past is, the future is never exactly like the past. Things are changing. And you're part of the causal net going forward, making decisions and choices. Go left or right or whatever, that then changes. Here, this is Jorge Borges' novel, The Garden of Forking Paths. Mm-hmm. You know, with each path, each step, each bifurcation point, you know, it changes the future going forward. So we are active agents in that. That's my argument.
You talk a lot about entropy in the book, really, that the kind of the fight against entropy is really the thing that makes us human. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, and here I would suggest Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein's new book, The Mattering Instinct, which is takes that idea, and there's a whole book on this, so you should have her on the show. She's great. It's that, and her argument and mine actually goes back to a paper by Tubi and Cosmides, the founders of evolutionary psychology, that the second law of thermodynamics is the first law of life, which is to say, natural selection designs us to carve out a little niche of order in the entropy of the universe. It's just running down. The world doesn't care about you. It wants you dead, and you are going to die if you don't do something like consume some calories and, you know, protect yourself and grow some defense mechanism, whatever it is. And so there, if you can just build from there, that our purpose in life is to then get organized and ordered. And then from there, you can go full Jordan Peterson, make your bed, clean your room, you know, work out every day. And so on. Anyway, and so that's really, it builds from there. It's
the book in many ways, I mean, it's a defense of kind of enlightenment values or an enlightenment mentality, rationality. It's also a defense of liberal democracy, very quickly, how do you get from that fight against entropy and the need to create order in your life or forward momentum to a defense of liberal democracy, which means generally broadly limited government, individual rights, kind of free enterprise type system, an expanding understanding that more people deserve the chance to create the life that they want to, things like that.
So here in that chapter, I asked the question, where would you rather live, North Korea or South Korea? Okay, everybody knows the answer, but why? Well, because they have more freedom. Yeah. Why does that matter? Who cares? And then if you keep digging, you'll get to a bedrock of, you know, it's better to be nourished than starving. It's better to be educated than ignorant. It's better to be literate than illiterate. It's better to have choice than and freedom than be enslaved. Okay, why? Well, because that's what we evolved. That's back to the, you know, carve out a niche of order in which I control my body, protect myself, make my own choices over versus somebody else doing that for me. And then you just start building from there. Okay, what are the best political economic systems to encourage that? Well, democracies are better than autocracies. Okay, not perfect, whatever, but better.
Yeah.
Right? Would you rather live in East Germany or West Germany before the unification? Obviously, everybody knows. If you have to build the wall to keep people in, they don't want to be there. Okay. So, I mean, and then you just go from there. And so I think that solves a lot of those issues. So civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, and so on, those are all based on individual autonomy to make choices.
I also want to commend you on the, when you talk about North and South Korea, that it was relatively recently that South Korea powered ahead in terms of GDP and things like that, which kind of drives home the idea that nothing is inevitable or nothing is written. I mean, it was very specifically through the 70s. I mean, South Korea changed how it functioned and became something like 30 times wealthier than North Korea.
South Koreans are 4 inches taller on average than North Koreans. Mm. You know, that's just nutrition. Well, why would there be a nutritional difference? This, because it costs money to buy good food and so on. It just comes down to, it's just obvious. And what I'm saying is that that's something that can be discovered. It's an objective truth. It's an empirical claim that can be tested, collect data. And that's what economists do.
As a final question or topic, talk a little bit about Skeptic Magazine. It was founded in 1992. It's quarterly. You've got a great website. I mean, it comes out on a daily basis, but the print issues are quarterly, right?
Yes.
What niche did that serve? What evolutionary, cognitive evolutionary niche did Skeptic Magazine serve?
Well, the whole skeptics movement began in response to Uri Geller and some of the other New Age astrology and psychics and UFOs and all that stuff in the 70s. And people like the Amazing Randi and Ray Hyman, yeah. Paul Kurtz, others, Isaac Asimov, Carl Sagan said, you know, we got to do something about all this crazy stuff that's going on there. And so that kind of started it. And then so it's a niche market for sure. But really, everybody should be skeptical. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a basic, all scientists start with the null hypothesis. Your claim is not true until proven otherwise. So if you go to a biology conference and you say, you know, this stuff about Bigfoot and Yeti, it's true. I found Bigfoot. Wow, okay. You want to name a new species and so on? Let's see it. Well, you see, here's what happened. It was 3 a.m. and I woke up and I grabbed my camera and it didn't work. And I managed to get one shot and it's kind of blurry and it's grainy. But if you use your imagination, you can sort of squint and see there's two legs in that. No, sorry. You have to come back with an actual type specimen of body. Right? And that's all we do apply to, you know, UFOs, the whole UAP thing. Could be true. You know, maybe. All right. So you'll get something like all those congressional hearings you saw over the last 2 years, right? You know, these are like high ranking officials and, you know, and pilots and so on. And I know this guy who actually saw the alien bodies. He touched the spacecraft. He back engineered it for DARPA and all this stuff. Okay. Who was that? Oh, I can't tell you. Well, where is this warehouse? It's classified. Can't tell you. Can anybody tell us? Well, not in this environment. Okay, can we go into another environment? Well, maybe. And this has been going on for 2 years, which really decades. That's why I have a $1,000 bet with Avi Loeb at Harvard, the Harvard astronomer, that by December 31st, 2030, we will not find evidence of aliens. And he says we will. Okay. You know, I like betting markets. That's a good way to focus the mind. And
can I make a bet with you that by 2030, $1,000 will be like $500? the discussion of UAPs and whatnot, and one thing that's fascinating is when you look at the actual testimony that people give, they're not even making the claims that somehow then get popularized out of it. It's interesting to me.
Well, so I hear in the book I quote Scott Kelly, the pilot and astronaut, who was in the space shuttle a bunch of times and thousands of hours as a pilot. And he talks about at a NASA press conference where they're asking about the UAPs. And he said, look, when you're up there, it is a really difficult environment to discern distance of objects, size of objects. And you'll hear these reports, oh, it was 100 meters wide and it was triangular shaped and it was moving at 450 miles an hour. They're just making these numbers up. There's no measurements of this. And he tells a story of being in the space shuttle where they're about to close the bay doors where they keep all the stuff. And they noticed like an instrument or a tool or something floating around. And they're like, oh, my God, what is that? We're going to have to get our space gear on and go out and do a spacewalk and get this thing. And so they took a photograph of it and blew it up before they did all that. And it was the space station 80 miles away. And they're like, all right. So his point was, you hear these stories, I clearly saw this. You can't trust them. Not even these professional pilots, astronauts, people that are trained in this, they still get it wrong.
All right. Well, the author is Michael Shermer. The book is Truth, What It Is, How to Find It, and Why It Still Matters.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.